Hey, 50 years ago this week in 1961, a novel by Joseph Heller went on sale. Catch-22 begins with an American airman assigned to censor the mail going home from the troops during World War II. Rather than just blacking out the sensitive parts, he starts blacking out passages at random, or entire letters. In the half-century since Catch-22's publication, the novel's title has entered the language, a metaphor for bureaucratic absurdity. But it took a while for the book to catch on, as NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
In August of 1944, Joseph Heller flew on a mission over the French town of Avignon. Sitting in the plexiglass nose cone of a B-25 bomber, Heller faced the very real possibility of death for the first time. That mission, says Heller biographer Tracy Doherty, shaped the way Heller thought about war, a sensibility that permeates his first novel, Catch-22.
After that mission over Avignon, Heller really understood that this is not an abstraction. They are out to kill me personally, and he didn't like it, and Yossarian doesn't either.
Yossarian is Heller's nimble creation, an everyman soldier who is trying as hard as he can to get out of the war. But the more he tries, the more he's caught in the famous catch. In this scene from the movie based on the novel, the actor Alan Arkin, who played Yossarian, spells it out.
Okay, let me see if I got this straight. In order to be grounded, I've got to be crazy. And I must be crazy to keep flying. But if I ask to be grounded, that means I'm not crazy anymore and I have to keep flying.
You've got it. That's Catch-22.
When Catch-22 was first released, it was not universally well received. Until then, books about war tended to be serious works, often tragic in tone. Heller's war was a black comedy, filled with orders from above that made no sense and characters who just wanted to stay alive. The novel seemed to offend some reviewers. The New York Times called it an emotional hodgepodge, but other critics took on the book as a cause.
It seemed to me like the first genuine post-World War II novel.
Robert Brustein reviewed Catch-22 for The New Republic. He says he was blown away by the book and the way Heller's depictions of war turned the idea of heroism on its head.
He was using a tone that is not normally used when you talk about war, especially wars fought by Americans. I mean, the language we use when we refer to our soldiers as our brave, heroic boys and so forth, we don't use language that indicates that they might be slightly insane. And that's what Joe Heller was one of the first brave men to do. And he ran into a firestorm as a result.
By the time Catch-22 came out in paperback, the word of mouth was more positive than negative, and Catch-22 became a bestseller. But Tracy Doherty says it was more than just the praise of critics that turned the tide in its favor.
Really what turned the tide, I think, was that the Vietnam War began to heat up and was more and more in the news, and Heller's book seemed to prophesy what was happening.
The young people who took to the streets to protest the war embraced Catch-22. Heller may have based the novel on his own experiences in World War II, but the voice that emerged captured the tone of a new generation, which had lost its respect for authority and refused to take anything at face value.
In the mid-60s, when what was being stated publicly, particularly about the Vietnam War, but about other social upheavals, what was being stated publicly was clashing so obviously with the images we were seeing on our television screens. And so I think in a large sense, the entire culture began to distrust language. And we were being told one thing and seeing another. And there's the paradox. And I think that's the heart of Catch-22.
But it wasn't only young people in anti-war protests and on college campuses who were reading the book.
Well, I was stationed with the 25th Infantry Division in Cu Chi, Vietnam, which was about 30, 40 miles southwest of Saigon on the north end of the Delta.
Mark Anderson read Catch-22 while serving in Vietnam. He carried it with him on forays into the jungle and lent it to other soldiers who wanted to know what he was reading.
I would tell people about it, and they'd get a kick out of it, and I'd let them have it for a day or two, and they'd read sections of it. But I think it had a lot of resonance with the Vietnam soldiers, again, because they were drafted. They didn't choose to be there, and it was pretty apparent once you had been there for a little while that this is silly. We're fighting peasants with BB guns with a 500,000-person army.
Anderson says Catch-22 took one of life's worst experiences and made it funny. Heller understood completely what soldiers encounter in war and identified with their frustration about getting caught in a situation over which they have no control. He turned that frustration into his famous Catch-22, an idea which perfectly captures the absurdity of war and the mind-numbing bureaucracy that supports it. Heller's humor, says Anderson, is what makes the book work.
It seems to make more clear and more obvious the futility of the war, because Yossarian just made fun of everything about it and everyone in it continuously, nonstop. And he did it in such a way that you couldn't help but laugh out loud at him. And I think the humor is unique, and I think the humor is what makes the book so powerful.
Catch-22 is a concept everyone can understand. That's why it so quickly became part of the language, a phrase to be called upon when there seems to be no way out of the traps life can set for you, and when humor really is the best response. And that, says Robert Brustein, is why the book has endured.
It's amazing to me that it's 50 years old, because I feel as though it was written yesterday. And I do think it still speaks to us. I think people should start reading it again and then looking it around at our political leaders, and they'll see them in a whole new light.
When Joseph Heller was promoting Catch-22, he was interviewed on NBC's Today Show by John Chancellor. As it turned out, Chancellor was such a fan of the book, he had stickers made up that read, "Yossarian Lives." Not long afterwards, bumper stickers started popping up all over the place. 50 years later, the message on those bumper stickers isn't out of date. Yossarian lives and seems to have quite a few years ahead of him. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skip.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Author Leah Hager-Cohen knows the feeling of truly getting lost in a good book. For her, it was Brian Hall's The Saskiad. She recommends it for our series You Must Read This, in which authors talk about a book they love.
Remember reading as a child and feeling the fine mesh of words catch you up so completely that you became enjoyably muddled about which was the real world and which the world of the book? For me, it was as though I gulped down the language of the story and grew fat with its cadences. They rang in my ears, colored my vision, and pulsed in my throat. As I got older, I lost some of that easy susceptibility. What had once been a permeable membrane between fiction and life solidified. If this sounds familiar, not simply the experience, but the wistfulness for it, then what a treat to discover the Saskiad. Brian Hall's 1997 novel about a 12-year-old girl growing up on a broken-down, dismal former commune outside Ithaca, New York. Saskia White is drunk on language, which she guzzles, transforms, and ladles out again in great improvisational scoops of storytelling. The cow is the coo, the house is a ship, boys are dregs, and old books crack and split to powder the air with the smell of graham crackers. Her imaginary companions include Marco Polo, Odysseus, and Tycho Brahe. Her more fleshly companions are her mother and the commune's last few stragglers, a couple of surly, solitary adults, and four younger children whom Saskia refers to as the crew. The book is so laden with fanciful coinages and lavish metaphors, it risks becoming precious. But Hall makes us feel that Saskia's investment in wordplay is something closer to a means of survival. We come to realize just how much she is awed and ostracized at her junior high school, burdened with too much responsibility at home, and lonely, oh so lonely, for the idea of her absent father, and above all, for a friend. Saskia's linguistic and imaginative feats are nothing short of heroic, a kind of self-rescue. Not that the narrative remains moored in make-believe. The Saskiad offers large-scale adventure, complete with an overseas quest. the day after she turns 13, Saskia embarks on a hiking trip in Scandinavia with her long-absent father and her new best friend. On her travels, she undergoes a sexual awakening and learns the sting of betrayal. It's one of the most ecstatic and troubling portraits I've ever read of a friendship between girls. But the principal journey remains an interior one. In the end, quite satisfyingly, Saskia's story is about the most ordinary yet crucial things. Growing up, finding first love, discovering how strong you are, how flawed you are, and how you can both change and keep constant with your own true self.
Leah Hager-Cohen is the author of The Grief of Others. You can comment on her essay at the book section of our website. That's at npr.org/books.
Over his long career, novelist Russell Banks has racked up an impressive list of award-winning books like Continental Drift, Cloud Splitter, and Affliction. None of them are easy or reassuring reads. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Banks' latest novel, called Lost Memory of Skin, certainly fits into that tradition, given that it explores the particular hell inhabited by homeless sex offenders. Here's her review.
You've got to hand it to Russell Banks. He's certainly not writing with an eye to please readers or to be taken up by book clubs across the land. Lost Memory of Skin is not aiming to be a crossover literary stealth hit. If you're going to read it, you're the one who will have to cross over to Banks's world, and it ain't very pretty on his side of the social divide. Banks's main character here is a 22-year-old homeless guy known only as The Kid, a name he adopted after doing time for using the internet to solicit sex from an underage girl. The Kid grew up haphazardly in South Florida, a modern-day lost boy abandoned to the brutal daycare of pop culture. The Kid's mom was always off partying, and his only consolations, from the age of 10 onward, were the company of his pet iguana, Iggy, and his computer, onto which he downloaded hardcore porn for 8 or 9 hours after school every day. Because of his criminal record, the Kid wears a GPS anklet, which monitors his whereabouts, thus ensuring that he stays at least 2,500 feet away from preschools, playgrounds, and all other spots where children might gather. When the novel begins, the Kid, with Iggy in tow, has found sanctuary under a causeway. There, he becomes part of a makeshift tent city of the dispossessed. All of the Kid's fellow campers are sex offenders, living on the primordial, swampy outskirts of a locale that sounds a lot like Miami. It's the kind of geographical and moral wild zone where it helps to have a 6-foot-long, 27-pound iguana sleeping with you in your tent at night. As repulsive as all this sounds, the first half of Lost Memory of Skin is compelling in a low-grade, nightmarish kind of way. Banks is going after a big idea about how contemporary culture can turn children into sexual commodities and losers like the Kid into predatory consumers. At first, given the Kid's addiction to skin flicks, the title of this novel seems faintly salacious. But as the novel progresses, the title speaks to the modern disease of disconnection that Banks is also diagnosing. Here's the Kid coming to an epiphany about his porn addiction. He told himself it was normal. Everyone did it, especially guys. Well, maybe only guys. And it was no big deal anyhow. In fact, it was boring, he told himself. But he knew better. He did it because he couldn't stop himself. He couldn't stop himself because watching pornography and masturbating were the only times he felt real. The rest of the time, he felt as if he were his own ghost. Not quite dead, but not quite alive either. A dust bunny, shaped like a person. Ironically, as inauthentic as the kid might feel to himself, Banks's much-acclaimed precision as a writer makes the kid's vacant inner life all too authentic to a reader. We step into the kid's skin, so to speak, not because it's a comfortable place to be, but because it's a place most fiction these days doesn't even attempt to take us. So Banks's ambition here has to be applauded, even if the final product falls short. Things start to go haywire in this novel as soon as an enigmatic character named the Professor turns up at the causeway and asks to interview the kid for a sociology project on sex offenders. Given the many times this novel invokes classic castaway stories like Treasure Island and Robinson Crusoe, having a character named the Professor appear makes those of us who grew up watching Gilligan's Island wonder if Marianne can be far behind. I'm being flip, but the Professor is such a pointlessly distracting character, morbidly obese, a double or triple agent for some spy outfit, that he all but wrecks the spare, blasted, end-of-world mood Banks has created. Long before the Professor makes his overdue exit, I was ready to hop back on the minnow and return to more civilized shores. Lost Memory of Skin is an uneven effort to excavate and redeem the dregs of modern society. Banks tells a disquieting story here that would have been even more powerful and more daring if he had told it straight, without subplots and second bananas.
Television cook Paula Deen is famous for enriching her recipes with a pat of butter, and then a few pats more.
And now, the ingredient that's going to make it so good and so rich, that's one stick of melted butter. I use a lot of butter because I can.
Many people on YouTube have watched Paula Deen make her donut burger. She calls her latest cookbook Paula Deen's Southern Cooking Bible. She writes that Southern food varies from place to place. New Orleans cuisine is different from Savannah cuisine, which in turn is different than in her hometown.
I spent my first 40 years, Steve, in Albany, Georgia, near the Alabama and Florida lines. And then about 24 years ago, it was 1987, I was relocated by my children's father to Savannah, Georgia. And that is now and always will be home.
You say you were relocated by him as if he put you on a hand truck and carted you up the...
And that's just about the way it was. That's just about the way it was. I was devastated.
Well, now, if you just go from Albany, Georgia to Savannah, Georgia, which is, after all, from one corner of one state to another corner, does the cuisine change even in that amount of space?
You know, it really does. I found that when I went from Albany to Savannah, you know, that I needed to put that white rice away. And I need to turn that into Savannah red rice, because they were big into that sausage, tomatoey, bell peppery rice mixture.
Now, you have a recipe here for what you call the best braised Southern greens. I think maybe people who don't eat greens don't get what it is about greens. Maybe you can explain, although you include the words bacon and butter in here. Maybe that begins to explain the attraction.
Well, you know, Southerners have never been afraid of seasoning. It's kind of the other way around. Our seasoning is afraid of us. You know, and I think sometimes the South gets a bad rap. But I've found over the last 10 years that in all my travels, you know, there's nowhere in this U.S. that eats more vegetables than us Southern folks. We love our fresh green beans and new potatoes and fresh butter beans. So I figure that it's almost like a balance, you know? We're eating these wonderful collard greens and turnip greens, which are so medicinally good for you. And, okay, so what if it has a little ham hock in it?
Well, let me ask, is it Southern cooking without the bacon and the butter? I think I've stumped you.
Maybe a cheating version, you know.
Okay, so it's important. You got to have it. Maybe this is a good moment to ask what makes cheese grits, because you have them in here, good cheese grits as opposed to not so good cheese grits.
Oh, my gosh. The one secret to making good grits is you've got to salt that water before you add your grits. Otherwise, you can put a box of salt in it, and it won't be salty enough. So that is the secret. There's a couple of secrets to cooking good grits. One of them is making sure that water is good and salty, making sure it's got some butter in it. Just like, you know, when you cook your pasta, you put a little olive oil in your water so it won't get gummy and stick together. And you want to make sure you use a whisk and whisk those grits for about 2 minutes in that boiling water. You want to make sure that all those grains of ground corn are all completely wet, because if you turn your back and don't stir them, then you've got a pot of golf balls.
I can picture that now. I think I've had it.
And you got to add a little milk at the end of your cooking time. And sometimes I'll accidentally trip when I'm walking across the kitchen with a block of cream cheese, and it falls in there.
I hate it when that happens.
I hate it when that happens.
And you just got to go with it, you know?
You just have to go with it and say, oops. Right. And, you know, people ask me all the time, Steve, do you and your family eat like this every day? Well, no, we don't. Of course we don't.
Let me ask about one more thing and take you back to Albany, Georgia because you include a recipe for what is described, this is your term, South Georgia caviar or redneck caviar. What is that?
Yeah. That's black-eyed peas.
Okay.
You know, we didn't eat much caviar in the South. Imagine although
that.
My grandmother would fry the best fish roe and serve it to us in the morning with scrambled eggs and grits.
Mm.
So that we ate our caviar in that form.
You know, because you mentioned your grandmother, I want to ask you one more thing. Does the smell of certain foods in the kitchen remind you of certain people?
Yes.
Your grandmother'd be one of them, I bet.
Yes. And my mother and my father. I lost my mother and daddy when they were very young.
Mm.
And my daddy's favorite meal was chicken and dumplings. And I was 19 when he died, and he was just 40 years old. And I got in the kitchen with my grandmother after my daddy died, and I said, Grandmama, I've got to learn how to make your chicken and dumplings just in case this is a bad dream and my daddy comes back.
Mm. And she showed you.
And she taught me how. And it's not hard, but it's physically tiring, because Grandma taught me that you have to make a tough dumpling. You want to be able to cut it with your fork. And in order to do that, you have to mix your flour and your salt along slowly with ice water. Well, I mean, that's a hard ball, you know, that you're having to work with. And it probably takes me 30 minutes to roll out that hard ball. But I know when I do that I've got them right. So it's work, but certainly worth it.
Paula Deen's Southern Cooking Bible is out now. Recipes are at npr.org, and you'll find a link to that video of her donut burger in my Twitter feed at NPR Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
To read the new memoir by Harry Belafonte is to discover a man who's packed enough life into 84 years for 10 people. There's this smash hit from 1956, Banana Boat Song. There's a film career that made great use of his matinee idol looks. And then there's Harry Belafonte, the activist.
In the 1960s, he was a confidant of Martin Luther King's. By the 80s, he was organizing We Are the World, the anthem for famine relief in Africa. For all his success, though, his path was not a sure one. It was his beautiful voice that led this child of Jamaican immigrants out of poverty and struggle.
Down the way where the nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountaintop, I took a trip on a sailing ship, and when I reached Jamaica, I made a stop, but I'm sad to say I'm on my way.
Harry Belafonte never intended to be a performer. Back in the 1940s, he was a high school dropout in Harlem, just glad to have a job, which he made his own.
Well, the job could not be considered artistic, but I did the job artistically. I was a janitor's assistant, and I loved mopping the halls, and I tried to look a little like Charlie Chaplin on skates as I just rushed up and down the hall with a wet mop, trying to take the boredom out of just all day long mopping halls and hauling garbage and stoking furnaces. But it paid off, because one day I did a repair in a tenant's apartment, and they gave me as a gratuity two tickets to a theater. So I went to this place, the American Negro Theater, and it was there that the universe opened up for me. I was first of all touched by the silence of the people in the audience. Everybody seemed so deeply reverential. I took my cue from that something was up. Something's coming. And when the curtain opened and the actors walked on stage, the evening overwhelmed me. And I decided what any device I could possibly find, I wanted to stay in this place.
You ended up meeting another young man who neither of you would ever, at that moment in time, have been able to foresee that you would become huge stars.
Well, the young man you're talking about is Sidney Poitier. I looked at Sidney, and Sidney looked at me. We were 8 days apart in birth, and I never really felt that he, nor I for that matter, had the credentials that we saw displayed abundantly with young actors that we were looking at. But each other.
I gather that when you and Sidney Poitier tried to see other plays in New York, you would share the price of a single ticket. I mean, how did that work exactly?
Well, you kept the stub. You walked in, and one of us saw the first half. We'd give each other an update as to what we just saw. And the lucky one got to see the second half. And it was called Sharing the Burden and the Joy.
You described Sidney Poitier as your first friend in life. And now you were about 20 years old, so it would have seemed as if you would have had friends before that. But tell us why you didn't.
Well, my life was quite nomadic. I spent so much of my formative years traveling back and forth between the islands of the Caribbean and New York, where my mother resided. I was born in New York, and my mother, with her away much of the time looking for work, a lot of times her children were left on their own, and that terrified her. So she took us back to the Caribbean, and for the next 12 years, I shuttled back and forth. I did not get rooted long enough to develop what many people have the joy of experiencing, and that is childhood friends.
Work all night and a drink of rum.
Daylight come and we want go home.
Stack banana till the morning come.
Daylight come and we want go
home.
In these songs from the Caribbean that might have come from your days as a child on a Kingston street, as you write in the memoir, someone might be singing as they're working.
The vendors used to sing those songs, baskets on their head, and they'd call out the names of the things they were selling. Guava jelly, guava, guava jelly, guava cheese. Come and get as much as you please. Now, let me say this about the songs of the Caribbean and almost all black music is deeply rooted in metaphor, because the only way that we could speak to the pain and the anguish in our experiences was often through how we codified our stories in the songs that we sang. And when I sing the Banana Boat song, the song is a work song. It's about men who sweat all day long, and they are underpaid, and they're begging for the tally man to come and give them an honest count. Count the bananas that I've picked so I can be paid. And sometimes when they couldn't get money, they were given a drink of rum. And there's a lyric in the song that says, "Work all night on a drink of rum." When people sing in delight and dance and love it, they don't really understand, unless they study the song, that they're singing a work song that's a song of rebellion.
You have been an activist since the early days of the Civil Rights Movement, very good friend of Martin Luther King Jr. One memory that you write about is of your mother and something she told you when you were a very little boy, about 5 years old. You call it your rosebud moment.
Well, I tell you, the severity of poverty kept us all deeply preoccupied with our survival. And nobody had survival skills and had greater cunning than did my mother. She was tenacious about her dignity not being crushed. And one day she said to me, she was talking about coming back from a day when she couldn't find work, fighting back tears, she said, "Don't ever let injustice go by unchallenged." And that really became a deep part of my life's DNA. A lot of people say to me, "When as an artist did you decide to become an activist?" And I say to them, "I was long an activist before I became an artist."
Harry Belafonte, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Harry Belafonte's new memoir is called My Song, and a new HBO documentary of his life is Sing Your Song. This is NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Smith. I know the show isn't over, but I do think it is time for a little dessert and time to leave the studio for a few minutes. Destination Manhattan. I'm here on the streets of the East Village, where there is no shortage of dessert options. In fact, I can look around here on this corner of 11th Street and 1st Avenue and see desserts as far as the eye can see. But we are not here to eat just any dessert. We are here to answer a question. Where did dessert come from? And I'm standing with?
Michael Crandall.
Michael Crandall is a food historian and the author of the new book,
Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert.
I presented a challenge to Michael Crandall. Find me the oldest dessert in New York City. And I'm not talking about the rock-hard donuts on the coffee cart on the corner, but the kind of dessert they might have eaten 500, 1,000, 2,000 years ago. We started our quest at Vigneros, an Italian pastry shop, to see what they might have been eating in the Middle Ages.
Let's get some pinoli cookies. Let's also get some ladyfingers.
Okay, ladyfingers. Where are those? Oh, I see them right there.
Then the biscotti, the almond ones.
We made two more stops for even older treats, and we brought our sugary haul back here to the studio. But before we eat, what exactly do we mean by the concept of dessert?
Well, the whole idea of dessert as something at the end of the meal is a pretty recent invention, but the idea of sweet snacks, something that is primarily sweet that you might have in the middle of a meal, or you might have outside of a meal, or you might have at the end of a meal, goes back, well, to the days when we started to sit down or perhaps recline, and to the days when sugar was something exceptional, something that only the very, very wealthy could afford. And as a result, they had the best stuff, and the best stuff was sweet.
All right, let's open up the box here. They've put it in a nice box tied with twine. Oh, and they've wrapped everything up individually. I'm feeling something hard here.
Oh, what you have there is biscotti. Now, biscotti were not invented in Seattle to go along with Starbucks, believe it or not.
These are these little hard cookie-like slices of bread, usually sweet with often nuts in them.
Yep. And those, well, originally when you used to go sailing, right? Everything would rot on the ship. You'd need it to last a long time. And so they made something called biscotto, which was bread that you bake, and then you cut it up and you bake it one more time. Eventually, what they started to do was they started to make cake, cut it up, and bake it one more time. Biscotto means literally twice baked. And that, well, it's a little hard to know how far back that goes because there's some reference to fine biscotti from about the 13th century, but we don't really know what that means. So the real recipes, the first real recipes for what you could identify as biscotti come from about 1550 or so. And there you've got more or less what you have in your hand, which is a mixture of flour, sugar, and nuts.
You can hear it crackle as I break it in half. Nice little almond biscotti. I feel like I've tasted the best that Italy had to offer in the Renaissance and the Middle Ages. But in order to go back farther than that, I have to go back to...
the Middle East.
To the Middle East. We went to a little cafe, and I'm going to let you say the name of this because it's Turkish.
And I'm going to mispronounce it horribly, but I'll give to take a stab at it. It is Gulu Olu. That's my best guess.
We had someone say it at the actual cafe.
Gulu Olu. Gulu Olu. Yeah, Gulu Olu.
And I am opening the box here. This Turkish cafe we stopped at specializes in baklava, and we have at least five different kinds here.
This particular company, Gulu Olu, comes from a part of Turkey where they're really well known for their pistachios. And when you taste it, you'll notice that these pistachios have this complex, interesting flavor.
Oh, it's excellent. It's... you can taste, you can sort of, as your teeth move through all the little flaky layers, you can taste each and every one of them. It's great. Again, I have to wipe my fingers off here because as anyone knows who has tried baklava, they are sticky. Now, we are eating Turkish baklava, but I know this is controversial because baklava was spread by the Ottoman Empire around the Mediterranean into Central Asia, really, and every country claims it as their own.
Well, one of the interesting things about doing this sort of archaeology, you know, the archaeology where you dig through layers of baklava instead of layers of dirt, is that you discover that civilizations have a half-life. And you can find that half-life, well, in the form of baklava, for example. So you can pretty well find the traces of an empire that ceased to exist, what, almost 100 years ago? By going to all the countries that have baklava. And, of course, now everybody says it's their own. Greeks claim that baklava is their own. Georgians have baklava. You find baklava in Iran. All these places have baklava. And I'm not someone who's going to say who invented it because I don't want to get into trouble. But it's all connected through this one particular political unit that existed once upon a time.
I'm speaking with author Michael Crondall, who has written the new book, Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Well, now that we've moved through the layers of baklava, we need to dig deeper in this archaeological tour of desserts. We need to find the place whence sugar came from, because they didn't invent it in the Middle East, did they?
They certainly didn't. Where sugar, well, sugar wasn't invented, it was grown, right? But where they invented the idea of refining sugar was definitely India. Everyone pretty well agrees about that.
So India, we're talking, they were eating sugary desserts how long ago?
India, maybe 2,000, 2,500 years ago, something like that.
And you say in your book that this wasn't for everyday eating. This was almost a religious item at first.
This was food of the gods. This was food of the gods because to boil all that sugar down, to refine it was outrageously expensive. And often what they did was they would combine it with various milk products. And as you can imagine, in India, milk goes bad, right? So they figured out all sorts of ways of preserving it. In Europe, the way they figured out to preserve cheese was to add salt. In India, it seems, they figured out that if they boiled down the milk with sugar, they would preserve it.
So we picked up this assortment of Indian treats. What do you think is most like what we would have been eating 2,000 years ago?
Probably the closest thing to that would be something called barfi.
Barfi, which one's that?
Barfi is this one. And now, is made in all sorts of ways. It's sort of like, well, you tell me what you think it tastes like.
Okay. It is intensely sweet, dense. It's one step removed from just sugar pressed into a little ball.
It really, I think, tastes a lot like fudge.
Yeah. In ancient India, would we have been seeing anything fried, anything like a donut? I see like a little, looks like a little fried ball of something here.
It's unclear how far the fried desserts go. There's definitely fried desserts as far back as, oh, let's say, 1,000 years ago. One of the ancient holy liquids was ghee, that is clarified butter. And so how do you make something holier? Well, you fry it in one of the holy substances.
So luckily, if you think sugar and milk and oil are all holy objects.
Yeah, holy donut is it. Yeah.
Yeah, you've pretty much invented the holy donut. Michael Crandall is a food historian and the author of the new book, Sweet Invention, A History of Dessert. Thank you so much for going on the quest and eating with me.
It's been an over-the-top delight.
Over-the-top is the correct word there. Thanks.